Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. It is January 22nd, 2020. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host, Ron Meniza. If you'd like to participate in the conversation about natural medicine, you can call us at 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. And our podcasts are also available now on Spotify. Yay. All right. I know. How exciting is that?
Very exciting.
Yeah. Where are you,
guest? I'm right here. Oh,
okay.
There I am.
Good.
Yeah.
All right.
It's exciting.
The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. So there's been a couple items in the news that are interesting. One that I keep hearing is that the human body temperature has cooled down.
Really?
So this is an interesting point. So my patients often come in and I take their temperatures. I take their oral temperatures and I take their temperatures with an electronic thermometer. It's an LED. It doesn't have alcohol in it and it doesn't have mercury in it. And mercury is really the gold standard or the mercury standard by which we really measure temperature. Temperature is traditionally measured by how much you raise mercury degree-wise through a calibrated thermometer. And so any thermometer that's not mercury is an analog. And there are thermometers, you know, those thermometers that have red stuff in them? That's alcohol. That's just rubbing alcohol.
That's not mercury.
No. Mercury is silver.
Right, it is.
Yeah, it's a liquid at room temperature and, it's silver, colored. But it is mercury.
Yes.
It's not silver. It's the color, same color as silver, but it is a liquid at room temperature. And, of course, depending how hot or cold it is, it will expand and contract. And if you put a thermometer in your mouth where it's encased in glass, it will expand, and it will expand at a calibrated rate. So these analog thermometers that you get at the drugstore that are LED, they're analog. They are analogous to mercury rising.
Okay.
All right. So when I take a person's temperature, I use an analog thermometer that's LED,
mm-hmm.
and you can get thermometers that are ear thermometers, and they are also analog and they are also LED. And when I go to some doctor's offices, instead of having a little handheld thermometer, they have a probe that's attached to a handheld unit. That's like when you go to Dr. LaGuardia's, they have a probe and a handheld thing. I don't know if those are more accurate than the LED ones.
I thought they did the ear thing with me yesterday when I was there.
Right. And you know what? I've had both.
Hmm.
I've at that office that when I went on Monday,
yeah.
It was our household. Just Dr. LaGuardia made out on our household in the last couple of days.
Yeah.
Pretty funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had an oral thermometer, and I've had ear thermometers there too. So
yeah.
I guess it depends on the
room
you're in.
Yeah, I think she stuck something in my ear.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I have, and it's funny at my office. I have both for children. I tend to use the ear thermometer. So the deal is. I learned years ago that normal human body temperature is somewhere between 97 and 99. I didn't learn that it was an absolute 98.6. My experience with my patients is that most people come in the 97s for the oral thermometer.
That would be me.
And I wondered if most people are cold or if it changes throughout the course of the day. But this is what happens. So according to this nice article from Scientific American, normal body temperature was thought to be 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, but in eLife, there was a study that shows that this number is outdated, and the figure was accurate in 1851. And the doctor that came up with the number was Karl Reinhard August Wunderlich, and he found it, and he did armpit temperature. So armpit temperature is another thing that you can do. And I will do that sometimes if for whatever reason I can't access a person's ear or mouth. And I don't do rectal in my office. But armpit is another way that you can go. You know, it's an easy way to go. You can put the thermometer under the patient's arm and they hold it there. And it's a way to gauge armpit temperature. But times have changed. Now, presumably, in 1851, Dr. Wunderlich used mercury. But we don't know for sure. I don't know that for sure. So there were some researchers at Stanford who looked at data from Civil War soldiers and veterans more recent cohorts that at that time, American men, and they did the studies on men, of course, the temperature averaged around 98.6 degrees. But the temperatures have steadily fallen, and the data find an average for men of around 97.5 degrees. This is really interesting because that bears correctly with what I see in my office. In my office, when I take people's temperatures, they're generally in the 97s. They're somewhere, and usually they're somewhere between 97.3 and 97.7. That's about where it falls. And isn't that funny? Because the average is 97.5. However, if somebody is healthy and they come in the 98s, that's just fine. If they're not sick, and then I have people who say my normal temperature is in the 97s, and if I'm rocking the high 98s, I have a fever. And that bears out as well. So the study suggests in the process of altering our surroundings, we've altered ourselves. We've changed in height and weight, and we tend to be colder. And there's a number of possible reasons for this combination of factors. One of them, this is really interesting, there's a decline in infectious diseases. People are most likely to have tuberculosis, syphilis, or gum disease. Gum disease is a big deal. And, you know, back in the day, I guess people didn't floss or people didn't have the same kind of oral hygiene. Or I don't know if some people did figure out that they needed to floss, but people didn't do that. So gum disease was common. And now people brush their teeth really well. Even if you don't floss regularly, you have interesting toothpastes that can get in between your teeth and, you know, that have antimicrobial properties. But a lot of people do floss and people go to the dentist regularly and people get good oral hygiene. And even if you don't floss, if you brush your teeth very well, you're going to help to mitigate some of that gum disease. And even if you don't use a xylitol toothpaste, the toothpaste with xylitol is going to be more antimicrobial than one that doesn't have it. Most toothpastes have essential oils in them. Even if you buy a commercial brand of toothpaste from the drugstore, people usually like to buy mint-flavored toothpaste, and there will actually be peppermint oil, wintergreen oil, or spearmint oil, all of which are antimicrobial. So if you brush your teeth regularly, even if you don't floss, you're less likely to have chronic infections in your gums. Tuberculosis was much more common 100, 200 years ago. People don't walk around carrying tuberculosis, and people are more likely to have syphilis because what? No tetracyclines back then. So people took arsenic to kill their syphilis, or people harbored syphilis. But people had little infections going on all the time, so their body temperature tended to run a little bit higher. Interesting, right? So in the United States, the other piece is that we spend a lot of time in temperature neutral zones. We don't spend time outside. And when you don't acclimate to the outdoor temperature, your temperature is going to wind up being lower. So people tend to be, you know, they tend to hang around in environments between 70, 72 degrees all the time, winter, summer, right? But it doesn't stress the human body. When you sleep outside, you have to deal with your outside surroundings. So your cave might be 40 degrees, or, you know, you just might be sleeping in an environment that's much colder, even if you're wrapped up in blankets or, you know, bearskins or whatever. So they did a study on the Tsimane, which is an indigenous people who live in Bolivia, it showed that infections can boost average body temperature. And infections will account for about 10% of resting metabolism, and lower metabolism is associated with only slightly lower body temperature. Even in healthy members of this population, temperatures dropped between 2004 and 2018, probably because if they had any modern innovations or less infections, their body temperature is going to tend to be lower. So. In the eLife study, Dr. Parsonet and her colleagues compared temperatures from three different data sets, from Union Army veterans of the Civil War, and from National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, and other data from the Stanford database that was collected between 2007 and 2017. Figures were women were not available from the earliest data, but from the later two cohorts they were. What they found was that body temperature, both men and women, decreased steadily over time. There's a doctor from the University of Maryland School of Medicine, Dr. Makiwak, who is not involved in the new study, says data from as far back as the Civil War is suspect. It's not to say that the new study is not valid. It could be, but you don't know. So you might not even be able to double check the data. And that Dr. Wunderlich's original 1851 data is questionable, and he had a large database of patients. We don't know how consistently he averaged, he measured the body temperature. And so the liver, did you know that the liver is the hottest part of your body?
You know, I didn't.
But it's interesting. And what's the coldest part of your body?
The coldest part of your body?
Yeah.
My toes.
Okay. And what are your toes covered with?
Skin.
Right. Mm. Yeah.
Well, that would make sense because the skin is the immediate. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay.
How do you feel about my hands?
How do I feel about your hands?
Yeah, when I touch you sometimes.
Boy, are your hands cold.
Right. Exactly.
Oh.
So, and yet, and that happens even when I'm healthy, right?
Yes.
Like if I touched you right now, you'd be like, ugh. What happened to your
hand? I wouldn't be.
What happened to your hand?
I banged it.
Oh, what did you bang it on?
I banged it on a project I was working on outside.
Oh, that's a good story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a story. I mean, things happen. Your hands,
right.
You know, my hands.
Well, it's much
are
better than if you were just, you know, in the bathroom and, you know, hit the shower curtain or hit the shower rail.
No, I was working on that shed in the backyard. And
all right.
I was doing a kind of project. I was digging a hole. Yes.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. And you got a little. Yeah, I got a little scratches when I was working on the shed.
You know what it is that because I don't work with my hands every day, my hands are not as tough as they used to be.
Your hands are tougher than mine.
I know, but they're still not as tough as they used to be because it used to be, you know, it was hard to get cut and, you know, your hands just get really calloused and hardened from using them all the time.
Yeah.
And when they're not, then you cut easier. So I have kind of wussy hands.
I see.
I have dishwasher's hands.
You do wash a lot of dishes.
I wash a lot of dishes.
Yeah.
And I cook a lot of stuff in the kitchen.
Yeah, you do.
I kind of have indoor hands.
Yeah, hold that thought because that's a good thought.
So
hold that thought
about
you cooking a lot of stuff. Okay.
Uh-oh.
So there's no absolutely normal temperature. There's obviously a range of temperatures because guess what? Biochemical individuality. And that is also what I see in my office, that people's temperature. People come in and they'll say, oh, my body temperature is 98.6. I'm perfect. Well, no, you're not. You're perfect for 1851. And like I said, I think normal body temperature is somewhere between 97 and 99. And when people are getting up in the high 90s, there's probably a problem. However, if you see a person come in, you know, if it's summer, or you have a kid who's been running around and then you take their temperature, it's going to be up. And, you know, if you take my body temperature when I'm in the middle of a 30-mile bike ride in the summer, it's probably going to be, you know, 99 or more. And that's normal. Your body temperature, your core body temperature rises when you're exercising. And that's perfectly normal, which is a good reason to exercise. Because why? Fevers are good. Fevers kill microorganisms. So if you're heating up your body regularly, you're going to have less infections. And one of the things I do is I tell people poor people who get Lyme disease or tick-borne illness in the summer to exercise to tolerance, because if they heat their bodies up, the microorganisms will die.
So how high can your body heat up to?
Yeah.
Before it becomes a problem or a danger?
Well, it depends on who you ask. So now we're talking about fevers. When your body's raised its temperature from normal to a higher level, usually for the purpose of killing microorganisms.
Mm-hmm.
And so the optimal fever, when we studied fevers in naturopathic college, we talked about the optimal fever. The optimal fever is 102 degrees. So if you can sustain a fever of 102 degrees, you're going to kill a lot of microorganisms. And in fact, we would often tell patients, if you're having a high fever and you're not having a seizure, you're probably okay. And the idea that you should take medicine to lower fevers is really not a good idea, because your body's making the fever for a purpose. It's making the fever because your body would love it. I mean, why do people have these higher resting body temperatures, 200 years ago? They had those higher resting body temperatures because they had infections. And so your body temperature is going to be lower if you don't have an infection. And your body temperature will rise if you have an actual cold or a flu or, you know, a GI bug or whatever microorganism you have, you're going to tend to have a fever. Now, parents get scared when their kids spike fevers and they get febrile seizures. Febrile seizures are actually, they're scary as heck, but they're not really a problem. You know, if your kid doesn't have seizure disorder and they happen to have a seizure while they're having 104 degree fever, they will probably come through it and be just fine. That's generally the case. But people get scared when they have, if you're an adult and you have a fever of 104, 105, which can, it may mean you have a really scary infection that's hard to treat. If you have the flu and you get up to 102, 103, and you have normal flu symptoms, you probably don't have to go to the hospital. Obviously, if you can't breathe and you have pneumonia, then you do have to go to the hospital. If you have a fever that's accompanied by really scary symptoms, like you can't breathe, or you have neck stiffness or stiffness in your spine or something like that, then you could have meningitis, and then you have to go to the hospital. So the problem is, if you have regular cold flu symptoms and you have a high fever, you may be just fine. If you're scared, absolutely go to the doctor. And the other issue is, if you have a really high fever, you may have a scary infection. It's not so much the fever itself. It's that it could be an indicator that you have something like meningitis or pneumonia or something that it's best, treated. It's best that you're under observation and that you're under the care of physicians. So if you're spiking a fever and you're 104 degrees for a couple of days and it bothers you, then go to the walk-in or go to the ER. It's a good idea. But I don't agree with the practice of taking drugs to lower fevers, because your body's making the fever for a purpose. There are things you can do to encourage the fever to lower, and that's to make yourself sweat. So if you can get yourself better, rather than taking acetaminophen, and you really shouldn't take aspirin when you have a fever. Because taking aspirin, you can get Ray syndrome, which is a serious that can heat up your brain. You can get seizures, and it's very serious. So don't take, if you have a fever, do not take aspirin. Bad idea. So if you are going to take something, it's safer to take acetaminophen, but I don't agree with the practice, because it's much better to try other things first. You can use homeopathic belladonna, especially if the person seems to be a little bit delirious and their eyes are kind of glassy and there's redness to whatever condition they have. So they have a big red ear infection or big red sore throat or a big red rash or something's red, back of their throat's really red, something like that. Give homeopathic belladonna, and that can help to break the fever safely. The other thing is just to make them sweat. If they can take ginger, if they feel like ingesting something, give them strong ginger tea. Ginger is a great, what we call, diaphoretic. There are herbs that can break fevers because they are diaphoretic. They induce sweating. And one of them is ginger. Another one is yarrow. Now, yarrow, you probably know what yarrow is. You don't know that you know what it is, but it grows in the grass all the time. Now, when in the spring, I'll show you the yarrow. And on the power lines where you don't cut the grass, the yarrow grows up and it has flowers. And yarrow, you can get horticultural yarrow that comes in pretty colors, comes in pink and yellow. But wild yarrow, the pretty flowers are white. And they're compound flowers. They have little tiny florets, and then they make a big flower, like kind of like Queen Anne's lace, except that yarrow is not in the, it used to become called the umbelliferase, and now it's a different family. But it's not in the same family as you know, your fennel and Queen Anne's lace and dill and anise. They're all in the same family. And it's not the umbelliferae anymore. What is it? So the if you look up umbelliferae family, it's a different family now. Oh, now it's called the Apiaceae family. Oh, guess what else is in Apiaceae? Celery and parsley. And if you let those things grow, they make these pretty flowers. And they're still called umbellifers, but Apiaceae is the current name of the family. Anyway, so yarrow's not in the family. But okay. Yarrow and ginger, if you do yarrow or ginger tea or tincture, you can help to break a fever if you're concerned about that. Hmm. Another great way to, if you have a big fever and you want to induce sweating, is to get in a hot bath. Get in a hot bath of 102 degrees.
Yeah.
Then you'll heat your body up, but you'll sweat and your fever might come down safely. And you will still, you won't be taking a drug to reduce the fever. And you won't, you know, when you take acetaminophen, understand that every time you take acetaminophen, you risk liver damage.
Ew.
Yeah.
Well, that's not good.
One of the most common reasons people have liver toxicity that they see in ERs is acetaminophen overdose, because people don't understand you can't keep taking your acetaminophen. So bringing a fever down, ways to do that are to, you know, induce sweating, wrap up in blankets, you know, get under the blankets, warm pajamas, get really hot that way, or get in a hot tub. Or take ginger. And then if you can break the fever that way, then you don't have to go to the hospital and you'll be more comfortable. And you're still using heat. When you sweat, you're still detoxifying. You're still getting rid of microorganisms. But it's really interesting. So if you go to the doctor and you find that, you know, your body temperature is consistently in the 97s, don't worry about it. The body temperature's lower for a number of reasons. One of them, unfortunately, is sedentary lifestyle. So I wonder if my normal body temperature is going to be a little bit higher because I'm more active. And yet when I take it, usually my healthy body temperature is in the 97s, maybe the low 98s. So the standard is usually considered to be more than 100 degrees for a fever. Although when people have fevers over 99, when people have temperatures over 99, they're usually sick, unless, like I said, it's summertime and they've been running around, and then it can get high, and that's normal. If you have a bacterial infection and you have a lower than normal body temperature, that's more concerning because your body's not able to mount a fever against it. So that's interesting. So if you go to the doctor and your body temperature tends to be in the 97s, that's normal, because normal body temperature has gone down for a variety of reasons, in that people don't have as many chronic infections, including gum disease. So interesting. And that people don't have syphilis or tuberculosis like they used to. And people are more sedentary. That's why. But so that was kind of an interesting thing. All right. So for our next interesting topic of the day, I saw a piece yesterday on the Today Show, and there was a doctor who had put together a diet. It was a diet for people with food addiction. So the thing is, I have a little bit of issues about whether food addiction is a real thing. And so if you look at various sources, there are various opinions on the idea of whether food addiction is real. So I have kind of a concern about it. And, you know, people will feel like, oh, my goodness, you know, I can't resist eating more than a bite of very reinforcing foods, like your favorite. What's one of your favorite foods that you just can't eat one of? Or just can't eat a little bit.
Chips.
Chips, right, yeah.
Ooh, you eat, chips.
You eat one chip after another.
Popcorn.
Yeah.
Ooh, popcorn.
Yeah.
Yep.
What else? What's one of your favorite things?
That I can't eat just one of?
Or that you
chocolate.
Can eat. Right. Okay. Yeah. Exactly. So you're a chocolate guy. You like popcorn and you like chips.
Mm-hmm. I like crunchy things.
And you didn't say any, I didn't hear you say anything about salad.
No.
Salad is not reinforcing. And yet I love to eat our salads, although you eat a certain amount of salad and then you're done.
Right.
And you're like, you can't eat anymore.
Right.
And same with the fish.
Well,
you know?
We eat the amount of salad that I make.
I know that that's right, but I don't feel like going for seconds.
And I'm pretty done with it at that point.
Sure.
You know,
sometimes I'm done with it before.
Unless that's all I have for a meal is a salad, in which case I would have more.
Right. Right. If all you're having was a salad and you weren't having a protein source as well.
Right.
But like when we have our fish, you don't feel like going back for seconds, do you?
No.
Right. Yeah.
No, I'm fine.
But with the chocolate, you know, we still have chocolate left from Christmas. I see little wrappers and I see, you know,
there's
maybe 10.
Nibblings. Yes.
Yes. Nibblings. And you keep eating them. And when you buy a bag of popcorn because you're on the road and you need to keep yourself going, do you eat, you know, maybe a couple handfuls and then you put the popcorn back? Exactly. Right. So how much that bag is gone by the time you're...
It depends on the day.
It's usually most of it.
It's a good chance.
My observation is you're not buying a little snack bag. You're buying a big bag.
Yeah.
And...
should probably like portion those out into like smaller bags and only carry those with me.
You can if you want to.
I thought about that.
Although you won't be satisfied. It's pretty funny.
No, I'll be... If I have more than one of those bags with me, I'll eat them both.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. So, because they're very reinforcing. Are you a food addict?
Am I a food addict?
Yes.
Well, I do need food to survive, so does that make me an addict?
That's a really good question.
Okay,
that is the rub. That's what I was after.
That's it.
Right.
Wow,
right.
I got it first time. Now, that's a rarity. This doesn't happen often, folks.
But the thing is... With food addiction, now there are people, lots of respect to people who consider themselves to be food addicts. And if that paradigm works for you and it works for you to maintain a healthy style of eating, I have respect for you and that's fine. I'm questioning the premise. I'm not questioning it for people who use it as a paradigm and the paradigm works for them. It's fine. Okay. So the deal is if you have a substance... that's very reinforcing, like an opioid or like cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
So those substances are addictive. Nicotine as well is addictive. And the reason they're addictive is they light up certain areas of the brain. So the argument about food is that all of these places light up the reward areas of the brain, particularly the nucleus accumbens, which is a part of the brain. Nucleus accumbens has a lot of cholinergic receptors or cell body neurons in it. So acetylcholine is prevalent in the nucleus accumbens. Now, and there's a big reward center there. So the nucleus accumbens lights up when you do cocaine, when you do heroin, when you do various things that increase reward centers. The other place the other time it will light up is when you're playing video games. Because video games are rewarding. So
that's interesting.
Sure, they do. They increase dopamine.
It's the same trigger.
It's a similar trigger. That's right.
Huh.
And video games are addictive because
yes,
people play them because they're very rewarding.
Yeah.
You can't just eat one. You know, you keep playing it and playing it. You're like, all right, you got through another level. I just have to go to the next level because it's like lights and colors and rewards and cool things happening, and it's interesting. And, you know, video games, it's like anything else. If you, anything you do, if the thing that you're doing is detracting from a happy, healthy life, then it's not a good thing.
Right.
And there are studies now that show, for example, children who play too many video games have issues with, they have mood issues. They have issues with mood and...
social contact?
Yes, mood and socialization. There are actually studies that show that. So with food, even Oprah admits that food is her drug of choice. So is that,
there's got to be, wait a minute, you got to draw a line here because there's got to be a point where food is a requirement of the human body in order to sustain itself,
you
correct?
You got it. That's right.
Cocaine is not.
Right.
Alcohol. Is not.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
Water is.
Yes.
So how can you be addicted to something that is something that is, you know, a normal thing that your body requires?
That is a great question. That's what we're debating here.
And
you got it.
I mean, salt and sugar, those are additives to food. So
yet,
they could be borderline.
Right. And you know what would happen if you never ingested any salt?
I would cramp up like the human pretzel.
That is correct. Worse than that.
But I need salt in my body.
You would die.
I would die.
You can't have no salt.
There are certain minerals you need in your body.
Yes.
Right.
Sugar, you could get away with not eating sugar. You can't get away with not having sugar in your body because your brain uses glucose for fuel. But
you can get that from food.
You can get it from food, but your body can make glucose. It can get glucose and it can make ketone bodies.
But it can't make sodium.
That is correct. You have to ingest that.
Mm-hmm.
You got it. That's right. I mean, you can't make a mineral. Your body cannot make a mineral. We're made of minerals.
No magnesiums, no sodiums, no...
No, you have to ingest those. Yep. You can make... There are things your body can make, like there are various amino acids your body can make. Your body can make citrulline. Your body can make arginine. Your body can make glycine. There are certain amino acids that are essential. Any nutrient that is essential, the word essential when attributed to a nutrient means that you have to ingest it. Your body can't make it. So there are various minerals that are essential, and magnesium, sodium, potassium, calcium, they are among them, right? So, and you can't make those. You can't make a mineral. You have to eat those. Protein you can synthesize, and you can synthesize those from amino acids, which is why people don't necessarily have to eat animal protein, because you can synthesize you can't synthesize all of the amino acids because there are 9 essential ones, but you can synthesize protein in your body, and there are certain amino acids that you can synthesize. So so when you talk about drug of choice, now there is something called binge eating disorder. That is a very real disorder, and there's also bulimia. So when you have binge eating disorder, you will eat as much food everywhere, as much food as you can find. And, you know, there's those people who will buy a large pizza and they can eat the whole thing in a sitting, and then keep eating. And they'll eat past the point of reason and satiety. They overcome their feelings of satiety. So that is binge eating disorder. But is food an addictive substance? It's debatable. And like I said, some people benefit from the idea that they have a food addiction and they treat themselves like they have an addiction. And so maybe they pick certain foods that they don't ever eat because they see them as triggers. And there is an organization, Overeaters Anonymous, where people identify as having a food addiction and they work on it that way. And you know what? Like I said, if that works for you, if that paradigm works for you, I think it's fine. However, is it really an addiction? What you said is very valid.
That's got to be a crazy addiction, quote unquote, to get over, because without the food,
you will
die.
You got it.
Right.
So
isn't this what happens to someone who's I'm thinking the
anorexic?
Anorexic, yes.
Yes. Well, anorexia nervosa. The word anorexia simply means you have no appetite. Anorexia nervosa is when you have a mindset where you shouldn't eat, and you have a fear of food, and if you eat, you'll get fat. You know, that's anorexia nervosa.
People die from it.
Yes, they do.
Because they don't eat.
Yes, they do. That is correct. They do.
Ouch.
Right. So I had a brilliant scientist once say to me, and this was a gentleman who was a neuropsychopharmacologist. Anyway, he did his studies in neuropsychopharmacology. And what that is studies of neurology, psychology, and basically the study of neurotransmitters. So he said to me, and he also had addiction issues, and he said to me, and addiction issues to pharmaceuticals. And he knew somebody who identified as having a food addiction. And he said that he thanks God for his addictions, because if he had to ingest some of his addictive substance 3 times a day just to stay alive, he didn't know what he would do. So that brings up what you said. You have to eat food or you will die. You can't not eat. I mean, you could do intermittent fasting, but you have to eat sometimes, and you have to eat something sometimes. So And the idea also is that when you eat very rewarding foods, it does light up the nucleus accumbens. Does it light it up to the degree that some of these pharmaceuticals do? That's a really good question. But as you said, you have to eat to live. And is craving food? So the thing is, you don't consider yourself to be a food addict because you're. You eating most of a bag of popcorn doesn't negatively impact your life. You eat that bag of popcorn, and you don't eat five bags of popcorn. You eat most of a bag of popcorn, and then when you're satisfied, you stop. There are various foods you eat that are highly reinforcing, and then you stop eating them. And even people, like myself, I've struggled with weight my whole life. It's probably, eating more of a, more of a type of food that is keeping me heavy. But am I addicted to food? Well, one might say if I can't stop myself from eating sweets, I'm addicted to sweets. And, you could make a case for that. But the other side of that is we are not wired for utter availability of all kinds of different foods. And we're certainly not wired for the high availability of very reinforcing foods. So the foods that you said you can't stop eating, like chips. Okay, so chips, what's the deal with chips? Chips have three things that you crave. They have carbs, they have oil, and they have salt. And there are three, the combination there, I know, the combination is very reinforcing. The other neat thing about that is that it has that combination of salt and, not salt, but carbs and fat, which turns on your neuropeptide Y, and your neuropeptide Y turns off your satiety signals. So that's one of the reasons you can't eat just one, because when you mix carbs and fat, sugar and fat or salt and fat, carbs and fat or, sugar and fat, it turns on neuropeptide Y which turns off your satiety signals, and you just keep eating and eating. That's why people can eat a whole pint of ice cream. Because ice cream is sugar and fat. Yeah.
I used to do that.
Yeah. Right. And I don't do that now, and I even will get the alternative ice cream. So if you eat a little bit more, it's not so many calories and doesn't impact you as much. So I do get some of the, and or if I get ice cream, I have a couple of spoonfuls. I'm able to not eat very much of it. So the thing is, so the other thing you said is chocolate, and chocolate, you've also got the chocolate. Chocolate is a very it's a very interesting food because it's you definitely have the sugar and fat thing going on. So that's part of why people like chocolate. But the other thing is that it's very interesting. If you like chocolate, chocolate is very complex food flavor-wise. It's very complex. So it's very interesting. It's reinforcing that way. So it's an experience consuming chocolate. And, that's why my office manager, Amy, said to me, she really prefers, we always keep chocolate in our office. And so everybody's happy.
For Amy.
Yeah, for everybody. But Amy prefers it if we keep 70% plus bars in the office, because the 70% plus bars are less reinforcing. They're very complex. And so when you have a couple of squares of high cocoa content chocolate, it's a great experience. You can't just eat one after another. You're often satisfied after eating a couple of squares.
I go along with that. I like that.
Yes. Mm. However, when you eat a Hershey bar or a Reese's,
you finish it easily.
You can be in for 500 calories of Reese's cups or bars, and no problem because the Reese's company knows that because they take
sure they
you
do.
To the bliss point. So talking about food addiction in the food industry, they talk about this idea of the bliss point, and the food industry wants you to get to that bliss point because then you're going to eat a lot of whatever food they're trying to sell you, and then you'll run out of it and you'll go buy more. So that helps their bottom line, the bliss point. So the bliss point is akin to an idea of addiction because you're not eating the food to nourish yourself. You're eating the food for pleasure. Now, which also begs the question, should we be eating to sustain ourselves or should we be eating for pleasure?
That's a yes.
Yeah. I'm with you there.
I think that's a yes answer.
I'm with you there. There are people who eat to live, and there are people who live to eat. I'm definitely a live to eat person. I like to eat. I like food. I like eating food. I like really good food. Mm. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And there's so much stuff. I mean, you know, the media doesn't think there's anything wrong with that either. Look how many food channels there are and food contests and restaurants and all kinds of interesting things. You know, people are, you know, falling over themselves trying to make more interesting and flavorful and cool foods. People like to eat. A lot of people like to eat. They enjoy food, and they enjoy food that tastes good. Is that an addiction? So the thing is, anything you do that negatively impacts your life is a problem. So you have to be careful when you talk about food as an addiction, because then what happens is you look at food as a toxic substance and it changes your relationship with food. And the thing is that food is something that should be, and food is something people do to celebrate. Food is something you do to nourish yourself. Hmm. Should you be looking at it as an addictive substance? I think that path is
fraught. I don't
fraught.
Like that idea. I think what food is laced with could become an addictive topic.
Well,
if your food has lots of sugar in it, like the food industry also figured out a long, long, long time ago, back when you and I were just little tiny poppers, that if you get kids addicted or get them to eat cereal, and there's enough sugar laced into that cereal that they'll continue to want to have cereal because sugar is an addictive substance.
Yeah, and pretty much. But again, that begs, is it really though? Because again,
well, if you take it away from, you take the cereal that the child is totally like hooked on, take it away from them and see what happens.
But again,
you tell me.
Okay, but children are reactive. Children are, is that an addiction, or is it that children are also creatures of habit, and if they don't care about they don't care as much about the consequences of what they do because they're children. So if you give them a highly reinforcing food that they really, really like, and then you take it away from them because you decide, hey, this is not healthy, child's going to get upset. Because you took away something they liked. I mean, if you took away their mush-mush, a stuffed toy, and they really like it, they're going to get upset with that too. Mm. Children get upset when you take away things, because they're very simple. They're like, I like this. What's the problem? They're not looking at their Cocoa Krispies or their Frosted Flakes going, oh, I'm eating this, but maybe I shouldn't be eating this because this is not so good for me. But I know I like the way it tastes. Maybe I'll just have a little. They're not going through that thought process. They're doing one thing. Yum, yum, yum. That's it.
Yeah.
And so if you take it away from them, you're taking away something they like. Is that an addiction? I don't know. The deal is,
we have a lot of overweight kids.
We do, but that's because we're feeding them very reinforcing foods. What I want to propose is that the tendency, you know what the tendency to want to eat highly reinforcing foods is? You know what that is?
No.
Normal.
Oh.
Because when we were Paleolithic creatures and we were hunting and gathering and looking for things to eat, when you found something that was salty, you ate it because salt was rare in nature. When you found something that was sweet, you ate it because it was probably good to eat. If something was excessively bitter, it might be poisonous. But things that were sweet were generally good to eat. And your sweet things, when you're hunting and gathering, are going to be basically fruit and, you know, plants that are safe to eat. We're wired to seek out sweet foods. We're wired to seek out salty foods because, like I said, salt is rare in nature and salt is essential to life. So, and fat as well. Fat was also rare in nature when, you know, back when people hunted and gathered, when they hunted and gathered, they found an animal that was down, they would eat it. And when they found those animals, when you're killing a wild animal, they don't have as much fat in them as domestic animals because they get a lot more exercise. So fat again was rare in nature. So you're taught to seek out fat. Now, once again, if you have an experience where you're spending most of your day seeking out food and you're seeking out very reinforcing foods that like that have a lot of sugar and fat, and you're overriding your neuropeptide Y all the time, that is a problem. And if, again, like I said, if the addiction model works for you, it's fine. So you got a message somewhere from someone. So
I did.
Okay,
yeah.
So why don't you...
Shout out to Billy, who's listening in right now.
Okay.
And the message says, Overeaters Anonymous believe in sugar addiction.
Yes.
And he states, my mom was a sugar addict first class.
Yeah. Okay. And I know. And Overeaters Anonymous does. Again, if you belong to Overeaters Anonymous and the addiction paradigm works for you and it makes you, and when you follow that and you stay away from sugar and you're happy and healthy, more power to you. The addiction model, I'm just saying that the addiction model is a model. Is it truly an addiction when it's a substance that you have to ingest all the time? So one of the things that I see is when people in my practice go on very restrictive diets, they don't stay on them. You know how the keto diet is very popular. You put yourself into ketosis by eating a very low-carb diet. Guess what kind of success rate I have with that?
It's probably not very high.
Not very high. There is a subset of people who go on the ketogenic diet and they do fabulously on it. Why is that? Because when they do it, they feel great. So being on the diet, it's easy for them to do because they feel great when they're doing it. So the way that they feel makes it not worth it to go ahead and eat that cupcake, or, you know, they're only going to eat, you know, keto friendly desserts or whatever. They're going to, you know, have their bulletproof coffee, and they're going to have their meat and their low carb vegetables, and they feel fantastic. So when a diet makes you feel fantastic, you might be inclined to stick with it. If you're not that person, and I'm going to point out that most people, that's not most people, because most people felt fantastic on the ketogenic diet. Most people would come to it and they would do it, but that's not what you see. Most people who try the ketogenic diet don't stay on it because it's too restrictive. It doesn't fit in with their lifestyle, and it doesn't fit in with it does actually fit their body type. Most people, in my observation, are somewhere in between. Most people need a certain amount of carbs, but not too many. And you know, there's that rough organization of people. Dr. McColl is a proponent of dividing people into metabolic types, carb type, protein type, and mixed type. And most people, in my observation, are mixed. Just like most people, the interesting is most people are that medium, that middle of the road circadian type. Most people they do well if they get up between like 7 and 8 in the morning and go to bed at like 10, 11 at night. Most people are that circadian type, followed by the early birds, followed by the night owls. The early birds, they're great if they get up 4:30, 5 in the morning, but they need to be in bed by, you know, no later than 9, better in the 8 o'clock hour. And then you have your night owls, who they do great all night, and they're going to be sleeping until noon at least. And so most people are in the middle. most people do eat too much carbohydrate. That's true. But do they need to go to the level of being ketogenic? Well, most people don't feel good doing that, and most people are not successful doing that. And some of the best diet plans are ones where nothing is forbidden. Now, mind you, if you're eating a food that makes you sick, that's no good. But every time you eat gluten or every time you eat dairy, you get sick from it, you get, you know, stomach upset or reflux, or you have a bad time in the bathroom, that doesn't make sense to eat that food. And that would be reinforcing for me. If I knew a food was making me sick, like acutely ill, I wouldn't eat it. I found these neat biscuits. And I decided that maybe I'm not so gluten intolerant. And the biscuits had 4 ingredients in them, the flour part of the biscuits. They were also flavored with fig and anise, which is very nice. But they were made of spelt, barley, oat, and lupin, which are those beautiful flowers that, you know, those lupin flowers. And I had these lovely biscuits, and they tasted really good. They tasted like kind of like digestive biscuits, those British digestive biscuits. Well, I didn't have a good time in the bathroom with those. And I wasn't sure it was them because I was also eating one of those low-calorie ice creams that had allulose in it as well as erythritol. So I'm wondering, I didn't know if the allulose and the erythritol were affecting me. Well, I stopped eating the biscuits and continued to eat the ice cream, and the digestive discomfort went away. So it's the biscuits. So I don't know if it's that I'm really gluten intolerant now. I can't eat barley or spelt, or if it was the lupin flour. There's something weird about the lupin flour. It just didn't agree with me. I can't eat them. So I'm not going to eat them because it's not worth it. As good as they tasted, I don't want to have that interesting bathroom experience.
No, it's not fun.
No.
No.
But and there are those that would argue that in order to stay on track, they have to completely avoid sugar. And if you can do that and you're happy and healthy doing it, that's great. I have to wonder if most people can really sustain that, which is why you have programs like WW and Noom and Pegan 365, all of which don't, they don't restrict. Well, Pegan 365 restricts dairy. It does restrict dairy. It doesn't restrict gluten, but it restricts dairy. It encourages you to not to avoid dairy. But the other ones, WW, they let you eat whatever you want. You just stay within your point. In, you know, WW case, you stay within your points. And Noom just has you make good choices. And it doesn't restrict foods. And if you can follow those, you know, people tend to do well on those. Now, it is true that sugar can light up the nucleus accumbens. It's questionable whether it lights up the nucleus accumbens to the extent that, you know, addictive drugs do. But the problem is that food is necessary to life. So when you cast it with the idea that it is addictive, then you're demonizing food. And people are going to have a more difficult relationship with it. And my feeling is if you really like those potato chips, if you can figure out a way to eat the potato chips without eating the whole bag, that's the secret. If you can figure out a way to eat the really reinforcing Reese's without eating the whole bar, that's the secret. And if you can eat 90% of your food really healthy and 10% whatever you want, you're probably doing a good job. And then if you have a goal of fat loss, then you have to figure out, okay, which of your macros are you overdoing? And is there, if you lower those macros, I know for me, refined carbohydrates is my deal. So if I lower my refined carbohydrates, it's easier for me to sit at a lower weight. I read somewhere that it's not proven that menopause causes weight gain. And
what?
Right. Right. Well, and
whose study is that?
So the point that was made when I was reading that was that menopause, that people just gain weight as they get older. And we know that there was that study that showed that that when you age, the dumping of fat into the cells, you don't remove fat from cells at the rate you used to when you were younger. So people tend to gain weight as they get older. But I don't understand, because that doesn't take into account the hormonal effects, that when your testosterone, estrogen, and progesterone go down, you don't push your hormone-sensitive lipase as much. And that is directly an effect of menopause. So when you're in menopause, and also as men get older and they have less androgens, you don't have hormone-sensitive lipase, because both men and women gain weight as they get older. Menopause may not be the cause, but it is definitely a factor, because, you know, what I see is most women, they put on weight in their midsection, you know, they put on abdominal fat, as they get older. And when an abdominal fat has to do with, the reduction in the estrogen, you don't have estrogen and progesterone giving you that nice curvy shape. And you become more insulin resistant. And you have more sensitive to stress and more sensitive to cortisol, and you don't have progesterone, combating that. So you tend to put on weight in your midsection. It's just what happens, and that is a direct effect of menopause. So I'm not sure what they said that. So I guess where I'm coming from is, if you feel that Seeing yourself as addicted to food is a useful paradigm for you to keep yourself happy and healthy. I support that. And if you go to Overeaters Anonymous, then I support that too. If you see sugar as addictive. And if you have binge eating disorder, is binge eating disorder an addiction? Well, it's a behavior that makes you sick. So binge eating disorder is something that is worth treating, obviously. So are other eating disorders, bulimia and anorexia. They're all worth treating because they are not, they are inimical to a happy, healthy life. But to think of food in general as an addictive substance, I think it's, without saying that it's wrong, I will say that it's fraught, and that what really needs to happen is people need to develop a healthier relationship with food overall so they can enjoy a variety of foods, mostly really healthy ones, find really healthy ones that they really enjoy and that work well for their bodies. And then if you have a thing for cannolis, once in a while you have the cannoli. Why? Because it's a pleasure, and eating should also be a pleasure. So that's what I have to say. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to go now.
I'm getting hungry.
Okay. Yeah, me too. I have a bar. I have like a protein bar and an oat bar. And yeah, I'm going to have a little of those.
Mm.
All right. So you have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician with my co-host, Ron Meniza. You can also email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. And you can now listen to our podcasts on Spotify as well. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores.